This is the Africa service of Vatican Radio.
Welcome to our half-hour daily program for Africa.
In today's program, you can hear our feature, Health and Healing. First, however, our bulletin of church news, followed by Africa News Panorama. We shall close today's program with a special segment dedicated to the Synod on Synodality. I am Festus Tarawali. Pope Francis continued his catechesis on the cardinal virtues at the General Audience on Wednesday, focusing this week on the fourth and final virtue of temperance. The Pope said the catechism describes temperance as the moral virtue that moderates the attraction to pleasures and provides balance in the use of created goods. Temperance, continued the Pope, helps us to act wisely in every situation. Deborah Castellano-Lubov has this report.
La quarta e ultima virtù cardinale, la temperanza.
Our ability to master ourselves and moderate our passions can lead us toward true happiness. Pope Francis offered this reminder during his weekly general audience on Wednesday morning in St. Peter's Square. The Catechism describes the cardinal virtue of temperance as the moral virtue that moderates the attraction of pleasures and provides balance in the use of created goods. Temperance, the Pope suggested, is the virtue of the right measure. Faced with pleasures, the Pope said the temperate person acts judiciously and enjoys moderately. For example, to appreciate a good wine, the Pope observed, is to take in small sips rather than drinking it all at once.
Per apprezzare un buon vino, assaporarlo a piccoli sorsi.
The temperate person, Pope Francis said, knows how to weigh words and doses them well. He does not allow a moment's anger to ruin relationships and friendships that can only be rebuilt with difficulty. Especially this is the case in the family, where inhibitions are lower, and where we all run the risk of not keeping tensions, irritations, and anger in check. The Holy Father acknowledged that the temperate person knows the time to speak and to be silent, both in the right measure.
Ma sempre nella giusta maniera.
The gift of the temperate person, the Holy Father said, is being balanced, which the Pope described as precious and rare. When everything in our hearts pushes us to excess, the Pope said, temperance combines well with gospel values. Pope Francis concluded by clarifying that temperance does not make one gray and joyless, but on the contrary, it lets one enjoy the goods of life better.
Non è vero che la temperanza rende grigi.
I'm Deborah Castellano-Lubov.
Echoing his catechesis at a general audience in a post on X, formerly Twitter, Pope Francis said, may we learn to cultivate the virtue of temperance. By controlling our words and actions, we can avoid useless conflicts and promote peace in our society, the Pope tweeted. In remarks after his catechesis, the Pope remembered those suffering due to war and renewed his appeal for the release of all prisoners of war and denounced the tortures many of them are subjected to. Pope Francis has written the preface to a new book to be published on Wednesday on one of his predecessors, Pope Pius X. In the preface, the Pope describes his predecessor as a meek and strong man, humble and clear. He also praises the early 20th century Pope for the depth of his catechesis and opposition to the First World War. Devin Watkins reports.
St. Pius X was a Pope who made the entire Church understand that without the Eucharist and without the assimilation of revealed truths, personal faith weakens and dies. Pope Francis offered that praise of his predecessor, Pope Pius X, who reigned from 1903 to 1914, in a preface for a new book entitled Tribute to Pius X, Contemporary Portraits. The book was written by Father Lucio Bonora, a priest from the Italian city of Treviso, the birthplace of Pius X, who was also an official at the Vatican Secretariat of State. In his preface released on Wednesday, Pope Francis said he holds the late Pope in high esteem, recalling that he would meet yearly with catechists of the Archdiocese of Buenos Aires on his predecessor's feast day on August 21st. The Pope said he enjoyed spending time with those dedicated to instructing children and adults in the truths of the faith, and Pius X has always been known as the Pope of Catechists. Pope Francis added that Pius X was a gentle yet strong Pope, a humble and clear Pope. The late Pope wept at the onset of the First World War and pleaded with the powerful to lay down their arms. "How close I feel to him in this tragic moment of our modern world," said Pope Francis of Pius X. He also frequently expressed his closeness to the poor, earthquake victims, and those suffering from natural disasters. Pope Francis thanked Father Bonora for his years of research into the life of Pius X, saying his dedication and passion emerge in the text. "The legacy of St. Pius X," concluded the Pope, "belongs to the Church of today and to the baptized of all ages who seek to be faithful to the gospel and to their pastors." I'm Devin Watkins.
The United Nations on Tuesday received financial pledges of over $600 million, or about two-thirds of the $1 billion it was seeking to raise to boost humanitarian aid to Ethiopia. The UN-hosted pledging event in Geneva was organized along with the governments of Ethiopia and the United Kingdom to help the country, which has been hit by conflict, drought and floods. The funds are meant to increase life-saving assistance to 15.5 million people and food aid to 10.4 million. Speaking at the event, the Holy See's permanent observer, the UN and other international organizations in Geneva, Archbishop Ettore Balestrero, expressed the Holy See's solidarity with the people of Ethiopia. He said there is need for concrete commitment for the African nation. You're tuned to the Africa Service of Vatican Radio.
African News Panorama.
I'm Father Paul Samasumo. Abdoulaye Bateli, the Special Representative of the Secretary General for Libya and head of the United Nations Support Mission in Libya, has tendered his resignation to the UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres. This week, Bateli expressed his decision citing challenges in mediation efforts. He lamented that his attempts to foster dialogue and address concerns were met with what he referred to as stubborn resistance, unreasonable expectations, and indifference to the aspirations of the Libyan people. Bateli, who assumed his role in September 2022, highlighted the crucial need for the Libyan leaders to reach political settlement through negotiation and compromise. He stressed the importance of prioritizing the aspirations of the Libyan people over narrow interests of a select few. The resignation of Bateli raises concerns about the trajectory of mediation efforts in Libya and the ongoing quest for political stability in the conflict-ridden nation. And staying with the UN agencies, in a recent report, UNICEF has said that only 37% of schools across Nigeria's northern region have early warning systems in place to identify threats on school children, such as attacks by gunmen and possible abductors. The UNICEF Nigerian report also observes that in the last 10 years, conflict-related violence has led to more than 1,680 children being abducted while at school or elsewhere. In Ivory Coast, authorities in the country's largest city, Abidjan, have been demolishing homes in low-income areas over what they say are public health concerns. This has left thousands without shelter and with nowhere to go. Early this year, hundreds of homes were demolished in February in mostly underdeveloped areas of the capital, Abidjan. The Ivory Coast government says the houses were built too close to a lagoon in this port city, and as a result, floods in the area have been deadly. The government also says that illegal structures are a breeding ground for waterborne diseases. Affected families and rights groups, however, have said that the demolitions are being carried out in a brutal manner and that they were causing disastrous consequences for many families already vulnerable due to poverty. You are tuned to the Africa Service of Vatican News.
You are welcome to this week's edition of Health and Healing. Last week, Professor Dr. Frank Asimwe, a urologist and organ harvesting and transplant specialist, explained to us the categories of organ donors. He said they can be living persons and those who have died, but in each case consent is required. He also explained that the surgical procedures of harvesting and transplanting an organ are very complicated and require specialized personnel, equipment, and facilities. In addition, human organs are delicate, and once the organ has been harvested, it must be transplanted in the shortest time possible, otherwise it will not function. For those reasons, trafficking human organs is very difficult. Dr. Asimwe also indicated the common organs that are usually harvested and transplanted. These are the kidneys, heart, pancreas, lungs, bones, bone marrow, the intestines, the skin, parts of the liver, and the corneas of the eyes. He, in addition, explained that organ harvesting and transplantation take place in authorized healthy facilities. In this edition, he outlines the criteria used to give such facilities the permission to carry out these surgeries.
It must be a full-fledged standalone hospital to begin with, preferably not set up for the sake of transplant. I mean, you've been doing other things, treating diarrhea, malaria, delivering mothers, treating accident victims. You've got a full-fledged laboratory, you've got transfusion services, you've got an ambulance. So it must be a hospital which is up and running and then wants to include these services into their services. They also look into the motivation. Are you being set up by some unscrupulous people to do illegal work? Once your labs are fine, you're treating malaria, you're conducting deliveries, your imaging is fine, then now they come to the human resource. Because you must apply for a particular organ, you cannot say, want to be a transplant center for everything. No, you must be accredited for each organ individually. But if you are big, you can come with a list of the organs you want to transplant, but you are going to be assessed for each organ. So why do we do that? For instance, if you use kidney, you must have a dialysis unit, because this is where patients who are on kidney failure are being life-supported. You must have a nephrologist resident, depending on your size, one or two. You must have trained dialysis nurses. You must then have either a resident transplant surgeon or a surgeon who can work with visiting transplant surgeons. But they must not come and do the transplant, and then when they walk away, the patient develops a complication and no one can handle it. Then now you go to the actual transplant unit. You must have two theaters sitting next to each other with an adjoining door, so that when they are harvesting, they're actually talking to each other.
In the situation when the donor is brain dead, but when some of his or her organs are kept alive and supported by machines, before his or her organ is harvested, the recipient must be identified. According to Dr. Asimwe, the recipient is chosen by the relevant health authorities using the following criteria.
In countries where the cadaveric program is taking place, there is a waiting list for the recipients. Then the next thing is to do a cross-match. The cross-match takes place after the authorization has been given. Let's say there are 200 possible recipients, they cross-match and they find the match hits 20. The system first goes for who has been on the waiting list longest. Second, the youngest, because you want to give it to the one who has got the best benefit out of it. So if I am 65 and you are 44, you are likely to get it before me. The hospital where the harvest is taking place takes priority to a hospital which is going to receive the organ, because it means the operation is very close. You can hit the 30-minute mark. Then you go for the comorbidities, the fitness of the recipients. How many comorbidities does the recipient have? What is his quality of life? What was the cause of his illness? Was it because of smoking, alcohol? All these things work for or against you. So if you have a kidney failure and you had been an alcoholic, you had been a smoker, all that will be in your database. So it means most likely you're going to keep going to the bottom of the list, because they are healthy young persons who unfortunately got organ failure.
It is illegal in most countries for a donor to sell his or her organ to a recipient. Dr. Asimwe explains why.
There is no way that a donor should initiate the donation that I want to offer my organ. That already smells of selling. That already smells of an incentive, a motive. So once you have donors who are walking around in the corridors, they are there, by the way. Those are the people who should be arrested. But of course, once they don't reach that point of organ donation, they cannot be incriminated. According to the law, you must first of all prove that there is no one among us your first degree who can give you an organ. Your children are either too young, because you must be 18 and above, or they are sick. You must prove to the council that they're not willing. The council should be able to pick a phone and say, ah, you are Frank's son, yes. We hear you are not willing to give him an organ. Yeah, I am not willing because it might be a light answer, but they must hear it from the potential first degree. So you must list to the council that no conflict of interest. I have 8 children. And number 1 cannot donate because of this reason. Number 2, number 3, number 4 for all this reason. My parents cannot donate because they are too old. They have got comorbidities. So you must first go through your first degree relatives before you move to the second degree relatives. We encourage our nephrologists and the physicians to help out this person to mend fences with his first degree for one simple reason. These are your best bait. When you get from a first degree relative, you've got at least 15 years, 20 years. We've got some people who have gone to 30 years. When you go to second degree and unrelated, especially unrelated, you're going to 5 years, 7 years, because you are pumping it with a lot of anti-rejection medication. So it's a second-rate organ, but it can be used. So for unrelated, usually we give to people who are desperate, no relatives, or those who are getting a second organ. They gave him a kidney. 10 years down the road, has failed. Now he needs a second kidney. He also goes on the waiting list. Then when you've satisfied all this, you can give him an organ. So you must prove that this person not only is related to you, but they have not been coerced, they have not been bribed or paid. And this is where the authorization committee comes. Once that transplant has not been authorized, it cannot happen. Should it happen and comes the knowledge of the council, the hospital which carried it out, closed. The surgeon who carries it out, imprisoned, license revoked for carrying out an illegal transplant. So it must be authorized.
In case of a living donor, organ harvesting and transplantation usually take place at the same time in the same healthy facility. The two procedures take many hours. Dr. Asimwe takes us through that process.
First of all, the theater must be fumigated and closed the day before. All the clothes that you use must be sterile. Now, in ordinary surgery, it's only the gown, the one we put on, the blue one or the green one, that is sterile. The clothes, the shirt and whatever is not sterile. On the day of transplant, the recipient and the donor must sleep in that sterile space the previous night. They are not going to walk in that day. They are bathed with the antiseptic. Because the biggest killer of post-transplant patients is actually not rejection, it is infection. So the level of infection control must be that high. Usually, the patients walk in onto the table at the same time. By the time the harvesting team is ready to clamp, now clamping is when you tie the arteries that supply the organ you are removing. Let's use kidney for that matter. By the time you clamp the renal artery, the team which is going to receive it must have already opened, looked at the vessels, happy with them, and give you a go-ahead. So usually the harvesting team says, are we ready? Can we go ahead and clamp? To harvest a kidney doesn't take less than 4 hours, sometimes 6 hours. The team, you must have very good light, very good anesthesia. You have to have 2 anesthetists. You cannot do it single-handedly. There must be 2 qualified surgeons and probably some resident surgeons and nurses. It's a full team of not less than 8, 6. So once the team on the recipient side said, we are ready, the nephrologist who has been doing dialysis, taking care of this patient, is usually the one who does what we call perfusion, must now time. Now you have 30 minutes for optimal, or 1 hour. So by that time, the organ is completely free and is basically sitting on the blood vessels. You cut carefully and hand over to the perfusionist. The perfusionist must flush that organ. We've got special fluids which flush out this patient's blood. They basically turn it from pink to white. There is no drop of blood in them. The other surgeon now comes and does a few trimmings. By that time, he will have seen this vein, this artery has this. I need to just trim it like this. The assistant is continuing with the surgery. And the assistant is not a rookie. He knows what he's doing. He's now closing. This person now concentrates on the organ. And often, the harvesting surgeon continues with the organ and hands it themselves to the transplant surgeon and usually joins the transplant surgeon. Usually the team sits and waits for the kidney to begin producing urine. It's usually around between the 5th and the 10th minute that the new kidney, after receiving all the blood from the recipient, begins producing urine. Some, of course, can produce urine immediately.
That was Professor Dr. Frank Asimwe, a urologist and organ harvesting and transplant specialist based in Uganda. And that was Health and Healing for this week. This has been Johnny Baptist Tumusime.
The Synod on Synodality, the Church on a three-year journey of discernment, listening, dialogue, participation and mission.
I've got a word to speak with somebody. I share with you because you should know that synodality shapes the church.
Hello and welcome to our segment, Synod on Synodality in Africa. This edition is brought to you by Sister Patsimo Veronica Ramokwebana. The word synod means journeying together and it entails listening to the Holy Spirit and to each other. So as to discern the path, we are therefore called to walk together. By calling a synod on synodality whose theme is communion, participation and mission, Pope Francis is drawing attention to the need for all in the church to walk together, listen to one another, broaden the forum of discussions and dialogue, and bring the church up to date with the demands of our contemporary human relations and intercommunications. This is indeed a good thing for the church. Therefore, this segment is devoted to assisting us have a better overview of what's on the ground with regard to the ongoing Synod on Synodality. In our program, we are joined by Sister Mary Kulbe-Zamora, an official of the General Secretariat of the Synod. Sheds more light on what Synod is and why Synod on Synodality. Over to you, Sister Mary.
In general, the term synod indicates a high-level assembly of bishops convoked by the Pope to discuss matters that might challenge the Church. Pope Paul VI established the Synod of Bishops as a permanent institution in the Church to help the Pope in his governance of the Church. The Synod of Bishops meets in two different kinds of assembly. A general assembly is convoked to discuss issues affecting the global Church, and a special assembly is convoked to discuss issues affecting a particular geographical area or continent. So far, there have been 19 general assemblies and 11 special assemblies.
And why did Pope Francis call for a synod on synodality?
Now, the term synod is an ancient term in the Church's tradition, but synodality is a relatively new term. Synodality refers generally to all the ways through which the Church makes visible our communion as the people of God. Synodality is making our communion visible and operational. As such, the liturgy remains the Church's most important manifestation of the Church's synodality. The Pope and each bishop are called to be visible principal and sources of unity within the Church. The Pope for the entire Church, and each bishop within his own diocese. This means that any synod of bishops is a making visible of the Church's communion. At the same time, the Church consists of more than the Pope and the bishops. Vatican II has helped the Church to realize once again that all of the baptized are anointed by the Holy Spirit and so participate in Christ's identity and mission as priest, prophet, and king. Baptism makes each person a missionary disciple of the Lord Jesus. For the Church to be synodal, therefore, or for the Church to show synodality, it is not enough for only the Pope and the bishops to visibly show their participation in Jesus' mission. For the Church to be truly synodal, the church must make visible the participation of all the baptized in Jesus' mission. So Pope Francis has convoked this synod on synodality to help the Catholic Church become more deeply aware of the need to visibly include all the baptized in Jesus' mission as priest, prophet, and king in and for the world. In order to more visibly include all of the baptized in Jesus' mission, this synod on synodality is inviting the church to discern and enact visible structures that place all of the baptized in dialogue with their bishop in engaging the church's mission.
Our gratitude goes to Sister Marie Colbezamora, an official for the General Secretariat of the Synod. Well, that's all we had for you today on Synod on Synodality in Africa. Do join us next Wednesday when Sister Marie expands more on Synod on Synodality. I am Sister Patsimo Veronica Ramokwebana.
I've got a word to speak with somebody. I share with you because you should know that synodality shapes the church.
You're tuned to the Africa Service of Vatican Radio. But before we go, I wish to express on behalf of our team hearty congratulations to our very own Father Richard Mjigwa of the Kiswahili program, who this Wednesday, the 17th of April, is marking the 25th anniversary of his ordination to the priesthood. The native of Tanzania is a member of the Missionaries of the Precious Blood, founded by Saint Gaspar del Bufalo. Praised be Jesus Christ. Laudetur Jesus Christus.